This is a Pinball News production.
My name is Jerry Stellenberg with Multimorphic. I've been doing seminars for, I guess, just about 2 years, and I finally figured out how to pack a seminar room. Just give away a $10,000 prize, and people show up. So we're going to talk about pinball. We're going to talk about our machine. We're going to talk about the themes that we're coming out with for our machine. But we're going to start by talking about just the general pinball landscape. So as most of us probably already know, in 2009, things weren't looking so good for pinball, right? There was one company building machines. It was stormy skies, clouds everywhere. Things weren't looking so good. People were wondering if Stern was going to survive. Stern, what, the maker, the only maker of real pinball machines on the planet or something? Well, they were at the time the only makers of pinball machines actually shipping them. But fast forward 4 years, and things look totally different. And we're going to talk about why. What changed between 2009 and 2013 now that makes pinball so... So I don't know if it's popularity again, but people are excited about pinball. People are building pinball machines, and things look good now. So the question is why? What happened? Some people will say, a lot of people will say, there's a 10-year cycle in pinball, that every 10 years, pinball comes back, that there's a lot of machines being sold, high volumes, then it drops down for a little bit, it comes back again. I don't necessarily believe that. I don't think we're destined to have a pinball resurgence every 10 years. Of course, technology changes, things happen. So I don't necessarily believe that that's the cause. The ego in me says it's because I developed a board 4 years ago, and everyone loves that board, and pinball's back. So 4 years ago, if you wanted to start a pinball company, if you wanted to build a custom machine, you could go to a parts supplier and buy parts. You could buy flippers, you could buy pop bumpers, you can buy all the switches you want. You can buy pretty much every component you want except for a control system. There was no off-the-shelf control system you could buy. Stern had their own. There were a couple of custom game builders that would, you know, hack together whatever control system they needed. But 4 years ago, we developed the P-Rock board. And now we have hundreds of customers using that board to build custom machines, writing custom code for existing machines, building their own machines. Is that the cause of the resurgence? No, probably not. But it made it possible for some of the companies now, the Zidwares, John Papaduke, the Skip B guys doing Predator. These are guys who are using the P-Rock and our driver boards to build their machines. And they couldn't do that 4 years ago. Pretty much we've talked to almost every company that's come out recently and said we're going to build machines, we've talked to them about control systems. They're not all using our system, but we've talked to every single one of them. And in fact, we've educated a lot of them on how to do control systems. So again, is it the cause of the resurgence? No, probably not. But it certainly helped. In my opinion, pinball is resurging now because of a behavioral change in consumers. I think it was Josh Sharp who was recently quoted as saying something to the effect of, people used to eat dinner at home and go out for entertainment. Now they do the exact opposite. They go out for dinner, they come home for entertainment. They have their video game consoles, they have their big screen TVs, they have their home theater rooms. And by the way, if anyone has a home theater room in their house that looks like that, then we need to talk. No, I'm serious. Come see me after the seminar. So, to answer the question everyone asks these days, is pinball dying? Clearly it's not dying. It's resurging. Why is it resurging? Because consumers are buying machines and putting them in their homes. I think we all know that, you know, arcades have been going away. People aren't putting pinball machines in as many movie theaters or bowling alleys anymore. People are buying them and putting them in their homes. Stern came out with a new low-end model, and Jersey Jack is here selling a semi-high-end model, and people are buying them for their homes. Will the growth continue? I say the growth will not continue. It will not continue if we continue to build games like traditional pinball games have been built for 30 years. The games that are coming out now, pretty much every one of those, with the minor exception of maybe the display technology, actually even the display technology, you could build a machine 30 years ago with the same technology. Same RAM, same loop, same graphics, same toys on the playfield. The machines coming out these days are the same thing they could build 20, 30 years ago. And that made sense while they're putting machines in locations, in arcades, in movie theaters, in bowling alleys. It makes sense to build those kind of games. single-themed machines and traditional-style toys. That makes perfect sense until you start putting them in the home. There's a lot of problems when you start putting traditional-style machines in the home, and we'll talk about that. And now I think that, like I said, consumer pinball will not continue to grow unless we change the types of machine we're building. We need to address a lot of problems. And let's talk about those problems. So let's discuss the typical path a consumer goes through. I'm sure some of you have maybe one machine in your house, or you're looking for your first machine. You go out, honey, I want a pinball machine. You go out, you buy one, you put it in your room. You play it for what, 3, 4, 5 months? What happens? You get bored of that same game. Every time you hit start, it's the exact same thing over and over and over again. So what do? Honey, let's buy a few more games. Put a few more games, you have them in your game room, you have a pool table, you have pinball machines, you play those for 6 months, what happens? The addiction starts. Pinball, I mean, I'm sure pretty much everyone here will be nodding their head when I say that you just get addicted to owning these machines. Honey, what do you think about selling the pool table? We never play it anymore. We're always playing pinball. People are laughing because they had this exact conversation. No more pool table. Now the room's full of pinball machines. Now what? Exactly. Move to the next room. Now what? Honey, we were going to send the kids to private school. Why don't we just send them to boarding school? Take their bedrooms. And of course, as soon as you ask that question, your spouse is probably out the door too. So you just kicked your kids out, you kicked your spouse out. But is that a bad thing? I don't know. I don't know, because then you start filling your house up. And, you know, it's kind of silly. But the point is, traditional style games, single-themed machines, one, they're expensive, so you're probably about to foreclose on your house since you've bought all these machines. They take up a lot of room. There's just all these issues. So we're developing a machine to solve these problems. All the problems we talked about, we believe we've solved with the P3. No, seriously. The problems we're talking about, it's antiquated technology. The toys, the playfield features, all this stuff is old. There's no new technology. These games are competing with high-tech video games. They're competing with high-tech, you know, the home theater rooms, the plasma TVs, the LCD TVs, whatever. Pinball machines with this old technology is trying to compete with all this new technology, the iPads, the tablet computers, the handheld gaming systems, and they just don't compete. Serviceability, who buys a pinball machine and wants to fix it all the time? There's a few hands going up. We buy these machines and we want them to work. We want them to work all the time. Our video games don't usually die. Our TVs don't usually die. Of course, there are exceptions, but generally, consumer technology needs to work. Traditional pinball machines need a lot of maintenance, and that's a problem for consumers. The footprint is the big example we just went through. You buy a couple machines, you have to find space in your house for these games. You buy a couple machines and they can squeeze in a room, and then you just run out of room very quickly. And then cost per game. Let's talk cost. How much is a machine from, I don't know, Jersey Jack? $6,500, $7,500? I think the first one was $6,500, now $7,500. So two games, if you buy two games, it's $13,500. A game from Stern, limited edition models, running $8,000 a game. You buy two limited editions, you're talking $16,000. These things are expensive. Most of us don't have that kind of money to throw around on new in-box pinball machines. So we have to address the cost issue as well. And we've developed this machine. This is a picture of our early prototype. That machine is in the game room. We changed the speaker box a little bit, but we're trying to address these issues. So technology. The biggest piece of technology, new technology in the game, is the same thing that you see in your iPads and your tablet computers and your touchscreen computer screens. We have a big LCD in the middle of the playfield. We can change the graphics on the machine. If we want to re-theme it, we can change the way things look. We can put instructions on the screen. We can tell you what to shoot at. We can change the backgrounds. We can add score and mode information, you know, all the typical stuff. We can recreate insert lamps. All these games have artwork and insert lamps. It's basically a piece of wood with painted artwork and blinking lights, and then a bunch of shots. Usually all those shots are at the top of the playfield. The artwork and the blinking lights are in the middle of the playfield. We've replaced that artwork and blinking lights with an LCD monitor. But it's not just an LCD monitor, it's an interactive screen. So again, just like your tablet computers or whatever, our machine can track the location of the ball. As the ball's rolling around, it can interface to those, or it can interact with those graphics. Just like your finger would on your mobile phone, the ball will interact with graphics on the screen. So we can have, you know, objects that you blow up, things that move in and out of the way of the ball as it's rolling around. There's just a ton of things you can do when you track the location of the ball and have an LCD under it. We can measure the speed of the ball. We can have modes that, depending on how hard you flip the ball, different things happen. Things that you couldn't do in any traditional pinball machine. We have the LCD underneath the flippers. The flippers are transparent. So we can change the way the flippers look. We can change the colors. We can put text on them. I don't think you can probably read it from where you are. It's kind of small text. But we could put pictures. We could animate the flippers. We could do all sorts of neat things. And that's just because we have a display underneath the flippers. We can do these visual effects. So that's some interesting technology we're adding to the top of the playfield. Underneath the playfield, we've totally revamped the control system. And I know most of you probably don't care about what's happening under the machine. We'll get into this a little bit more when we talk about serviceability. But again, the PROC we developed these driver boards. This is a driver board. This board is almost the equivalent of those traditional boards that are about this big in your machines. These boards usually go in the back box. You have a big bundle of wires that run down the playfield. The few guys that like servicing old machines probably like that. Everybody else, these things go right next to the components they're driving. So if a problem happens, a coil dies or whatever, you run back on that 6-inch length of wire and you look at the board and you figure out the problem. So our machine has a PROC board. It has an off-the-shelf computer. It's not a special computer with a parallel port or something that's 20 years old. It's got a USB port. It talks to the PROC over the USB. There's nothing special about that computer. If the computer dies 15 years from now, you just go to the store, get a new computer. It's going to be, 50 times as powerful as today's computer, and you're going to drop it in, and everything will still work. And then we have our chain driver boards, LED boards. We have a board that will drive RGB LEDs. It's a little tiny board. We got rid of the switch matrix. We have a little board that will drive switches or will read switches. Little tiny boards that go everywhere under the playfield. So serviceability becomes a lot easier. Replacing boards becomes a lot cheaper. You probably might even have some backups. You're not going to go buy a lot of replacements for those $300 boards that are in the back box, but you may buy some of the $50, $60, $70 boards to have as backups for if something happens. Open source. Our machine is going to be completely open source. The framework is open source, and the games, all non-licensed games, will be open source. If we come out with licensed games, of course, we can't open source those. But and I know this is a buzzword in the industry. A lot of people come out and say, we're going to develop games, and they're all going to be open source. Everyone gets all excited. Yay, we can finally change the code if we don't like it. And then what happens, no one ever releases their code. So why am I different? Why am I saying this? What proof do you have that I'm going to release the code for our games? Well, we've been developing software frameworks, game code for PROC-based projects for 4 years now. Every single software project that I've personally been associated with in the pinball world is open source now. You can go download our frameworks now. You can look at the code. You can look at some of the games we've written. You can look at the code that a half dozen of our customers have written. It's open source now. We're also going to be open platform, and what that means is the system will allow you to write your own games from scratch. If you don't like the rule set we release with one of our games, you think you can do better, go for it. Not only would we love to see you do it, we'll help you distribute it. Develop a game that you really like, that other people like, we'll help you get it out there. Network connectivity, another buzzword everyone's throwing around. I know Jack's talked about it. I think Gary Stern's talked about it. I believe that every single consumer product, electronics consumer product these days, should have some kind of network connectivity. It doesn't make sense to buy any big item like a pinball machine that's being developed in the year 2013 and not have network connectivity. You shouldn't have to stick a USB stick into a computer to update the thing. Every single pinball machine shipped in the next couple of years, in the last couple of years, should have had network connectivity. Again, why should you believe that we're going to come out with network connectivity for code updates, for stash tracking, for these things? I don't know if any of you were around at 2 o'clock today, but we ran a little simple demo of two of our machines, two P3 machines, connected together over a network, and people could battle each other. It was a short demo. We had some technical difficulties with one of the machines. It didn't run very long, but we did demo the technology. And in fact, when we talk about our themes later, one of our themes is very well suited for network gameplay, where you have a machine in your house, you jump onto the internet, your machine talks to a server or something, finds other people that are connected and want to play, and you can physically play pinball against people in real time across the country, across the world. So footprint, this is, again, the big example we talked through earlier. The P3 is a single machine, many games product. Once you buy a P3, you have a machine, you have a cabinet, you have flippers, you have legs, you have slingshots, you have the LCD monitor in the playfield. Why do you need more of those? How many sets of flippers do you ever play at once? John, how many flippers can you flip at once? Three? Two? Yeah. So how many does anybody need? I guess some people have parties a lot and have people over and they want a bunch of machines, and that makes sense for those. Most of us buy a machine, put it in our game room, probably play it for a lot for the first month or two, and then we never play the thing again, or we play it once a month, or we have these machines sitting here. It just doesn't make sense to have 25 sets of flippers. So you buy the cabinet, you buy the system, and then the upper playfield, everything behind this raised scoop here, is a module. The shot layout physically lifts out of the machine, and you can replace it with a brand new shot layout. It sounds complicated. It's like a 60-second change. We're going to have a couple latches on the side, one wiring harness, so one connector you pull out, clip the latches, pull the playfield out, stick a new one on, relatch it, plug the connector in, you're good to go. The system will automatically identify the module you have plugged in. It'll load up the software that works with that module, and you're good to go. Very simple change. So the plan is to ship a machine with two games right out of the chute. It's going to have two upper playfield modules, two complete games, two very different themes. And then every year after that, we'll hopefully develop two or three more games. Those will be a lot less expensive. We'll talk about cost in a minute. But you can build up your library of games. You've only taken one spot in your house. You can keep your kids. You can keep your spouse. You can, and it's a lot less expensive. So hopefully you're not foreclosing on your house. Serviceability, we talked about, the small boards. The other thing is, thanks, Brandon. Most of you have probably seen us playing with these last couple days. This turns a piece of wood into a pinball machine. Literally, you take, say if this floor was a pinball machine, I drop this down on top of it. Well, now we have flippers, we have slingshots, we have a drain, we have the coils to drive them, and we have one wiring harness. So everything on the top side of the P3, every single assembly, drops down on the top. Screws in or latches on, and you're good to go. We've turned a piece of wood into a pinball machine. So to clean a pinball machine, John, again, I'm picking on you. How long does it take to shop out a pinball machine?
Way too long.
How long?
You're doing it right. 2 weeks.
And what takes all that time? Right, so unscrewing everything, some are mounted from the top, some are mounted from the bottom, some you have to hold onto something here and unscrew something here. Even just taking the flippers off, you got to undo that big bolt and take them out. And it's a pain in the butt to stick the bolt back in when you're reassembling it. I used to shop a game, I used to take about a day to disassemble it, a couple days to clean and wax it, another day to put it back together. Our machine, you can literally break down to the bare wood in 10 minutes. You unscrew the things, pull them off, wipe it down, clean whatever you want to clean, drop the things on. If you want to replace the flippers, you pull them off, get new ones, stick them right back on. Serviceability is completely different now. It literally takes 10 minutes to completely change out everything on your machine. So we talked about the short wiring runs. We talked about the small and expensive boards. No more switch matrix. No more wiring or debugging diode failures in weird locations that are affecting switches on adjacent rows on the same column, all that fun diode debugging, automatic level detection. Again, features every machine should have. In 2013, shipping a machine without an accelerometer to figure out the tilt of it doesn't make sense. Why should you have to get a bubble level, stick it on your machine, crawl down under the machine, try to level it? You don't know if it's level yet because you got to climb back out, look at the level. It's still not right. You climb back down and adjust the legs a little bit more, and eventually you get it. Well, our machine has an accelerometer on it. It reads out the values to you. If you're on the floor unscrewing or screwing in the leg levelers, it's sitting there telling you what the level of the machine is. It's just much easier. Every machine should have this. Self-calibrating flipper strength. Other machines are coming out and they're saying, we can adjust every coil on our machine. We can change the strength of our pop bumpers, of our flippers. Okay, everyone in the world can do that. Everything's controlled by software in modern pinball machines. Everybody can adjust the strength of everything. The thing is, the user shouldn't really have to adjust those things. The pop bumpers, maybe the flippers. The flippers, if you're on a low line voltage or whatever, you might have to bump up the strength of your flippers a little bit. You shouldn't have to adjust the kick-up strength of a vertical up kicker or a pop bumper or something like that. The flippers, our machine, because like I said earlier, it can measure the speed of the ball as it rolls across the play field. It can automatically launch a couple balls. It can detect when those balls are in front of the flippers. It can automatically flip them. It can automatically measure the speed. And it can decide what's optimal for that game. So you run into the service mode, you hit self-calibrate, it launches a couple balls, it flips them, measures the speed, it adjusts the strength of the coils to get that optimal speed. Self-calibrating flippers. Here's the big one. Cost per game. Everyone who's come and asked me cost, I say $9,500 buys you two games. And everyone had their eyes bug out. $9,500, that's a lot of money for a pinball machine. And it is. It's a lot of money for a pinball machine. But look at our competition. Our competition is in red or in blue. So the first game you buy, we're asking $9,500. The first game you buy from someone else is going to be anywhere from $5,000. Some people are saying $5,000 to John Papaduke selling games for $10,000 a piece. I averaged it out. I said about $7,000, and I just kept that constant for a competition. So you buy the second game from our competition, it's another $7,000. Two games, $14,000. Our second game is free. We ship the machine, with two games. So $9,500 gets you two games. That's $4,750 a piece or so. $4,750 is probably the least expensive pinball machine, new in-box pinball machine you can buy today, besides, I guess, Stern's new watered-down consumer model. Game number three. Go buy a game from Stern, from Jersey Jack, from Zidware, from Skitby, $7,000 more. You're at $21,000 for three games. For us, you just go buy another playfield module. We've developed another one. It costs $800, $1,000, $1,200, a lot less than $7,000. So $21,000 for three games. For that same $21,000, you can buy what? Two games for $9,500 plus about $12,000 more, so 12 more games. You get 14 games for $21,000 versus 3 games for $21,000. 21. It seems crazy. Okay, so to summarize, most advanced features. We have the most feature-rich game. We also believe we have the most advanced features. We believe our machine can compete with your touchscreen machines, your handheld gaming systems, your home theater rooms. Significantly better serviceability, significantly better use of space, significantly less cost per game. And as we talked about, we're taking pre-orders now. They're $9,500 a piece. You get two games. You can order here. We actually have forms here if you want to pre-order them. You can take pre-orders online. We're expecting to ship games in 2014. In fact, I'd love to come to Texas this show next year and have our machines ready to go. We hope to start producing them, to start building them in a. We actually have contract manufacturers that'll build them for us. We're not going to spend $2.5 million to build a factory. We're going to have contract labor assemble our games for them, for us, and we hope, like I said, to ship them early next year. This says, where are we now? The reason it's backwards is because we've pretty much taken the opposite approach as everyone else in the industry. Everyone else announces a theme. We're going to go do, pick one, Wizard of Oz, Hobbit, Predator, Avengers, X-Men, whatever. They announce a theme, they show some artwork, people get excited, people want to drop down money for pre-orders or whatever. And then they have to wonder, is the company going to be able to deliver a machine? Is the company capable of building a pinball machine? Do they have the control system? Do they have the mechanics figured out? Do they have the ability to assemble them? You have to sit there and wonder. We've taken the opposite approach. We've built so much technology into our games that we had to prove that it worked. We had to prove to people we could build it. We had to show that this touchscreen technology in pinball is cool. It's exciting. We had to show that we could build cabinets, that we could build a playfield, we could build flipper assemblies. We had to show all that. Until we showed all that, we couldn't go out and announce themes and say, hey, we don't know if any of our technology will work, but give us money because we're going to go do a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory pinball machine. So we've taken a different approach. We've built our prototypes. We've proven our technologies. You can physically interact the ball with the graphics on the screen. You can play it. You can test it for yourself. And it's there. We have the hardware control system. We have the software framework. We have three playable prototypes now. Two of them are playable. One of them is getting there. It's playable in there. We haven't built the full upper playfield for our third prototype yet, but it's still a playable machine. But so let's talk about the difference between our prototypes and what we're going to ship. Because everyone walks in and they see our prototypes, and they, you know, they're unthemed. They don't have a lot of artwork, and that's clearly not what we're going to be shipping. These are prototype machines. We were verifying our technology. We were proving to people we could build a machine. So what we're going to go to market with, we're going to give people options. Again, we're talking about a consumer market. Everyone else sells a game, and they decide what the artwork is. They decide what the cabinet looks like. They decide what exactly you're going to play. And then they take your money. You don't get any choice. And that makes sense, again, for location, for arcades, for movie theaters, for bowling alleys. Let's define a game. Let's get people to buy it. They don't need choice. They're just putting it in an arcade. What are they going to choose? But in the consumer market, people need choice. People have different furniture styles. People have different needs in their homes. So we're offering different cabinet styles. The two machines we have in there, one's made out of cherry wood, one's made out of oak. And when we go to production, we're going to have machines that we have silk screened or some kind of screened artwork that we can apply to the cabinet and just have it swappable. It's not going to be Velcro. It's not going to be painted on the cabinet. It's not going to be silk screened wood. It's going to be a swappable side art, swappable head art, and every game we come out with, you'll have the option to buy artwork and theme your machine. Backbox options. One of our machines, if you go into the game room, has a backbox, a full backbox with Translate. The other machine has just a speaker box. We're not going to put a display in the backbox. We have a display in the playfield. We have a display where you're looking when you play pinball. Some people are putting displays in the backbox. In fact, that's pretty much where displays have been for the life of pinball. The DMDs, before that, the alphanumeric displays. And if you ever watch a new person play a pinball machine, they're hitting the flippers and they're looking down. And something happens on the screen, and they're waiting for the ball. And eventually the ball comes out, and they're like, why did I just wait 60 seconds for the ball to come out? They have no idea what's going on the screen. They're looking at the playfield. The display belongs in the playfield. So no, we're not going to put a display in the back box. It doesn't make any sense. The other problem with the display in the back box is as soon as you turn off the machine, it goes dark. So that pretty game sitting in your game room with that pretty display, as soon as you turn the power off and walk out of the room, it's dark. What's it need a display for? If we put Translates in there, the picture is still something interesting to look at in your game room, even when the machine's off. So playfield artwork, that is dynamic. Every game we come out with will have different playfield artwork. The playfield artwork we're showing on our machine right now, really there isn't any. We have that white wood around our LCD monitor. It's just prototyping material. It's actually PVC material. We did that because it's easy to work with. It's easy to build prototypes out of. The final machines will have artwork. It'll probably be some generic artwork around the LCD monitor so it can tie in with a bunch of different themes. The ball channeling, you'll see our machines now have these acrylic tubes that feed from the vertical up kickers down to the flippers. Those won't be on the final machine. What we're going to do is we're going to separate the the paths from the upper playfields, that we're going to separate them from the paths that feed the inlands. So the person designing our upper playfields for us can decide what mechanism gets the balls from the vertical upkickers to the lower playfield. It'll be themable. They can be wire forms. They can be vacuumed form tubes. They can be pretty much whatever the designer wants. And then software. Of course, all the software running in the game room now is demo software. It's just illustrative of the technology we can do. We have the ball rolling over asteroids making animals spin around. Very simple, silly software, but just to show you that the technology works. Now we're working with people like Dennis Nordman on real themed games. And that's what we're going to talk about now. Well, after we talk about questions. Anybody have any questions about the system, about the company, about the machines, about anything I've been talking about? Yes, way in the back.
So it seems like you're limiting your design to only one third to one quarter of the point two.
Mm-hmm.
There's no possibility of having, let's say, drop targets or prop numbers anywhere below that. Is that correct?
The question is, you've probably all heard because he just yelled over everybody, is because we're changing out the module, the module playfield is just the upper portion. It's about the upper one-third of the machine. Are we overly restricting designers like Dennis in their ability to create interesting playfields? Actually, if you walk through the game room out there, and I'd ask you all to do it, walk through the game room and tell me how many games have interesting features in the lower two-thirds of the machine. Some of the most popular games ever in pinball, Medieval Madness, Attack from Mars, even Whitewater, pointing at Dennis because he designed it. Most of the popular machines, there are a couple exceptions that have a ball scoop maybe halfway up the playfield. The majority of pinball machines literally are painted artwork for the first two-thirds of the machine, and then shots, ramps, loops, Theater of Magic I have in my house. I look at it every day. It's got the pretty much exact same layout. It's got two-thirds of artwork. The trunk starts beyond the two-thirds in the upper third. It's got two ramps. It's got loops. It looks like, because we have this huge LCD in the playfield, it looks like we've taken the whole machine away and given the designers no freedom to design anything, but it's not the case. But even to address that point, if it were the case, it's technically possible to float things over the LCD. In fact, again, These flippers sit down on top, the flippers activate, the slingshots activate. These guys are on the LCD. They're sitting there floating on top of it. Our targets that we have on the side of the machine are floating side targets. Dennis and I talked about floating pop bumpers. How to design things in the area of the LCD that don't get in the way of our ball tracking or that don't have to be mounted directly to the LCD itself. So to address your point directly, most games are already in the upper third, so we're not restricting that relative to other games. But even if we want to, we can develop things that float over the LCD. So we can address that. Please.
The LCD touchscreen. We've already seen a large clear insert recently that either the insert's cracking or the clear coat over it's cracking.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do about that dotted one for ball water tearing?
So the interesting thing, and I apologize for the contest, I completely forgot to pass out the entry forms for the contest. Everyone's looking at me like, we were supposed to pass out entry forms. So actually, can I ask you all to do that now? We're going to pass out entry forms, we're going to pass out pens. I'll address your question in a bit, Lloyd. Thank you for it. On the way out, I'll just ask you to drop your entry forms in. We'll put a bin out near the door. Just walk by the door, drop your entry form in the bin. This is an entry form for those of you who don't know, we're giving away a free P3. The machine we're talking about, we're giving away a free one. We don't have one here. We're not giving away the prototype. What we're doing is essentially putting you on the pre-order list for free. We expect to ship the machine in 2014, like I said, and at that point, no money spent on your behalf or by you. It'll be a free machine. The winner, good question. The winner will be announced during the regular awards presentation at the end of the show. Tomorrow at, I believe it's 2:30, you don't need to be present to win. All you need to be present is here to get this form, fill out this form, drop it in the bin on your way out, and we'll do the contest. We'll do the drawing tomorrow. You'll have your contact information on the form, so if you win, we'll contact you and let you know. So now the question is, will anyone listen to me while I'm talking and filling out a form at the same time? I still need to address Lloyd's question, so let me do that first, but thanks. So our insert, the one over the LCD, is Lexan.
Can you repeat his question?
Yes, I'm sorry. He's asking about our insert over the LCD. How are we protecting the LCD, and how are we making it so that doesn't basically get all screwed up? Are we clear coating over it? Is the clear coat going to get screwed up? We haven't figured out everything yet. There are some issues to address, but it's a Lexan insert, which is, I believe it's 200 times stronger than glass. It does tend to scratch a little bit, but there are new materials coming out that are scratch resistant. Our insert actually is just wedged in there right now. It's flush with the surface. It's wedged in there now. You can literally put a glass remover on there, pull it up, suction cup, pull it on there, pull it up. If in 3 or 4 years your Lexan cover is screwed up, just throw it out and stick a new one in. Yeah, easy. Everything about our machine is easy to replace. You had a question.
You're talking about some open source code, so what languages are you writing the code in?
Good question. Our software framework, the one we're developing most of our games on, is written in Python. It's a high-level scripting language, one that's pretty easily accessible for most programmers and actually even for non-programmers. We have a lot of people who don't have a lot of programming experience that are very successful using our platform. In fact, our game framework is that. It's a game framework. It has the handling for launching balls, for tracking ball numbers, for everything else. People just drop code into it. So we're going to start with the Python framework, and then we're going to interface that to a graphics library, a very common game engine, such as either Panda 3D or Unity or something like that, a very commonly used software game engine. So doing the graphics stuff is something that people can relate to as well. Thank you. Yes?
What assurance do we have that future modules will ever be made?
What assurance do you have that we won't go out of business in 6 months and more modules? You have no assurance. You have no assurance when you buy a Nintendo that Nintendo won't die and not develop any more games. Of course, they're a big company. You don't expect that to happen, but yeah. Of course, we hope that obviously our first machine, the machine you buy is the expensive part and the following games are the cheap part. So if we're able to sell enough games to justify the games, then probably we have enough money to go develop our mini modules. The other thing is that our games, that our modules, again, we were talking about open platform. So even if we, for some reason, don't, other people can. If there are 10,000 P3s in the world, Stern should probably develop third or upper playfield modules for us. Other pinball companies, I mean, they make revenue by selling the modules. We already have the games out there. Why don't they just drop playfields into them? Independent designers, consumers, you guys can develop your own playfields for them. Anybody can. So you have no assurance that we will. Of course, we plan to, but yeah, we can't guarantee it, but I'm not in the business to go out of business next year. That doesn't sound fun. There was a question. Yeah.
I played last year, but I haven't played this year yet.
Okay.
How many, does it support multi-ball, or how many can it track?
Does the game support multi-ball? I think it's more related to the ball tracking. Can the ball tracking track multi-ball? The original prototype last year could not. It was a single ball. It was a very coarse grid. We weren't tracking the ball very well. This year, we've completely changed our ball tracking technology. It can track multi-ball. The truth is, once you get to 3 or 4 balls, it doesn't even matter if it works, because the balls are everywhere, and you're not really watching each and every ball. You don't know where they're going.
I can hardly track 2.
Okay, very good. So our technology can track 3 or 4 balls. Beyond that, there's so much overlapping data that it really doesn't even matter. Yes. Are we planning an app store model? Yes, that's exactly what we're planning. The same way you download games or applications for your mobile phones or tablet computers, yeah, that's what we have. We're network connected, so we intend to develop additional software. Other people can develop software, stick them on our app store, and yeah, download and update the games. Yes?
Will there be a coin-op version, like a routable version?
Will there be a coin-op version? Yeah, I should have listed it on my differences between, or actually the options that customers have when they buy a machine. We're thinking about offering a coin door option. So, of course, we have to solve the lockout problem. The thing about a consumer model thing is you don't have to lock people out of the machine. You don't have to protect random fingers from jumping in there or people.
We got a 3-year-old in the house.
Good point. So we intend to offer CoinDoor as an option. The cool thing about these little switchboards, in fact, we have a switchboard inside the cabinet right next to the flipper buttons. This is what reads the flipper buttons. And there's unused inputs into here, so all the CoinDoor inputs will tie in directly to the switch. So there's no technical challenge to put the CoinDoor in. It's just a matter of cost and logistics. Yes?
How many cabinets can support for like a system?
Okay, so you're asking about the networked multiplayer games, how many cabinets can connect together? It really depends on the game that's being developed for it. We could come out with a head-to-head game, or one of the things we're going to talk about is well-suited for having a group of people all play against each other. There's nothing technically challenging. Well, it's challenging, but there's nothing technically keeping us from being able to add games that talk to each other or a whole group. In the back again.
Does your system support more than two flippers? Does it support upper or lower play buttons?
Does the system support more than two flippers? And I'm guessing you're asking, can we put flippers in the upper play field? I'm going to hurt my back bending over to pick this up over and over and over again. This thing plugs on from the top. We could do a four flipper setup. We could do crazy things down here. We could do zipper flippers. We could do crazy stuff that this just flops on. Yes, the upper playfield, of course, can have whatever the designer wants to put on it. If he wants to put in a flipper, he can do that. And in fact, we have patents pending on a lot of our technology, but one of the things we've patented is remote activating coils. So coils that activate and pull through a cable or through a remote activation system, a device somewhere else. So we can even mount flippers really close to other objects where you can't fit a coil. Like those flipper assemblies that you put in standard games, they're pretty big. If you look underneath, they're pretty big devices. It's hard to find room underneath the playfield for all that stuff. But we can just run a cable or run a rod somewhere else, have the coil remotely located in the cabinet or whatever, and you can put flippers pretty much anywhere. It depends on what the designer wants to do. There was a... Okay, yeah, good question. Let me address the side issue, because it looks like the side stuff on our stuff is fixed. I've talked about the modular upper playfield. In fact, the switch banks we have on our side, same deal as the flippers. They plug on from the top. So if a designer wants to, they can redesign whatever's going on the side of the cabinet, and they can add a flipper, another floating flipper to the side. Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got Python, you've got open source, you've got open counter, tech motherboard, etc. That's all great. But you got network connectivity. But am I going to see a blue screen of death? Am I going to have to deal with viruses? What OS are you having supporting your framework?
Okay, so the OS is really independent of are there going to be viruses or whatever on the computer. You can have viruses for any computer. But right now we're running on a Linux system. We will probably stick with a Linux system. You don't find too many viruses on a Linux system, but you could. There's nothing precluding that. It's a computer. You know, any of your consumer devices that plug into an internet, you never know. I mean, people may find a way to hack into it. We're technology guys, though. We deal with this for a living. We've worked in the network industry for years and years. We in fact, I used to work for a company that built security devices for internet products. So there's no guarantee. It's just like there's no guarantee we'll be in business in 3 years developing playfields. There's no guarantee someone won't figure out how to hack into our system and do something. But, I mean, that's true for every product. Wizard of Oz has a computer in it. It's got the same problem. Stern's talking about putting network connectivity in their games. They have the same problem. There's no magic answer saying no one will ever be able to break into our system.
The advantage you have, you're starting from the ground up. Mm-hmm. You can make it a closed appliance depending on, you know, I don't want something in a Linux perspective at VNC and remoting into my machine. Mm-hmm. The point that I'm making is that the average consumer that buys this, like whether like an iPad, they don't have to worry about them. Mm-hmm. And you don't want them to worry about them.
Correct.
Not, and then from a retail perspective, you put it out somewhere, you have that same issue. Because I don't want images of porn or something popping up on my bottom of my plate.
You don't?
I may.
Okay.
But
okay.
He
doesn't want his 3-year-old to see it. Yeah, right. No, that's a good point. We need to address that. That's part of the architecture of our system.
Right.
We have to architect a lot of things into it. We have to architect the network connectivity. We have to architect ways to do updates. We have to architect the game framework, and that's a part of it. Absolutely. It's not something we're not thinking about.
All right.
But yeah, thank you for it. Yes.
Your switchboard, say something like a slingshot closure. Closes the board. Does the board fire the slingshot, tells the computer what it did, or does it tell the computer and then the computer fires?
Okay, good question. The way the PROC is architected, the PROC is the interface between the game and the computer. The question he asked was, does the switchboard automatically tell coils to fire in response to a switch event for like a pop bumper, something that needs to react very quickly? And I think you're asking because if it had to send that switch event back to the computer and the computer runs some code and sends an activation command back to the coil, it takes too long and the ball's gone before the coil activates. The way the PROC's architected, the PROC gets the switch events from the switchboard. The PROC has internal logic that the programmer can tie a switch event to a coil activation. The PROC automatically tells the driver board to pop the coil. It happens in microseconds. It's essentially instantaneous. So, no, the switchboard does not activate the coil. The switchboard sends the switch activation to the PROC. The PROC decides what to do with it.
And it's
very quick. Yes, it's all done in hardware. There's no software involved at all. Software sets up the hardware, and then the hardware takes over and does everything. Any other questions? Yes.
Can you elaborate on your open platform? Are you actually providing schematics and interface documents for building additional hardware controllers and things that may not be currently covered by your device system?
How far are we going with opening our system? We are going to define the hardware specs so you can build your own modules and plug them in. We'll define our electronic specs so you can interface to our control system. And we'll release software development kits so you can develop your own software for that. We hope to give you every tool you need to develop a complete game on our platform. But let's remember that we're not selling a machine that only works if people take this system and develop games for it. We are a game company. We're going to sell the machine with two games right out the door, and we're going to continue developing games. So we're taking the model like Nintendo. Nintendo comes out with a new video game system. It comes with a couple games that Nintendo's developed. Nintendo continues to develop games over the years. As well, a bunch of other companies do. EA Sports and a bunch of other companies develop games for that system. Same deal here. Sir, yes?
Will there be an option to have like a slave unit so you can have head-to-head in your house and not have two PROC cores, two computers, etc.?
Will there be an option to have two units in the house talking to each other that don't both have PROCs and computers?
Using one computer, one board, or we have two standalone machines.
So, will there be a dumbed-down system that doesn't have the control boards that can talk to the main system for head-to-head gaming? Probably not, no. Probably every system will be complete with a computer and a PROC and everything else so that it works as a standalone device, and then you can choose if you want to network them together. Just a couple more if there are more questions out there. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about like a tournament server? Is that a whole other piece that's coming?
Yeah, good question. I think I had it on a slide. I didn't actually address it. I didn't actually say anything about it. But because we're network connected, we've talked to a bunch of the tournament players about how do we connect our game to tournament servers. And some people think we should go and develop a tournament server inside the platform. I don't think that makes sense. I think anybody, somebody, whether it's us or anyone else who wants to, can develop a tournament server with some kind of publicly defined interface to that server, so that our games can talk to that server, so you could network a bunch of our games together and play in a multi-machine tournament. But there's no reason we shouldn't be able to have our machines talking to that server along with Stern machines or Jersey Jack machines, Zidware machines, all talking to the same server. The server itself should be open enough that other machines can talk to it as well. I don't know who's going to develop it. I mean, our focus obviously is delivering games and cool software and fun things to play, but we hope to interface to tournament servers, whether or not we find the time to develop it or other people do. We'll work with other people who want to develop it for sure. Yes, sir?
If you did something like that, how would you enforce, making sure all the games had kind of a consistent setup, consistent tool setting?
Okay, so jumping into the tournament situation, how do you ensure that two machines in separate, whatever, room, states, countries, are set up similarly? Well, interestingly, with our machine, because we can track the ball, because we can do things, we can figure out the level of machines, we can tell how many times you've hit certain shots, you can tell how fast the ball's moving on them. You can try to handicap machines, but the truth is there's challenges there, and Yeah, I don't have an answer for you. That, and all that stuff is to be developed, to be architected, to be figured out. But our minds, we hope, are in the right place. Yes?
Is there a certification process for the open source people that are going to submit their own games?
Good question. So is there a certification process for developing games and making them distributable over our system? It's possible when you write software for a pinball machine that you lock on a coil or you do something that could just that could be really bad. You could blow up transistors. You could actually start fires. So it's probably not wise for us to allow people just to randomly distribute their games to everybody. So probably we will have some sort of certification. We'll at least have to test the code and then make sure everything's safe.
Make sure it's a quality game.
Are we the judge of what's fun and what's not fun? I don't think we are, but we do need to make sure at least the game's safe. But again, a lot of this stuff is to be determined. We need to figure out a lot of this. We're telling you our plans. Right now we're working on prototypes. We're about to talk about themes. I probably need to cut off questions so we can move forward. Let's take one more question, and then we'll get Dennis up here to talk about our first theme.
Hey, what's your profit margin?
What's our profit margin? What's the profit margin in a private company? Well, here's the deal. If we don't make any money, we can't continue to build machines. It's very expensive to build pinball machines. I know a lot of people saw Stern selling machines a few years ago for $3,000, $4,000, and they say new ones coming out for $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, and they say, what changed? You guys are just taking killer profits. I guarantee you no one in the pinball industry is making tons of money hand over fist selling these machines. We have so much technology in our machine that it's expensive to build them. We have to teach people how to build them. We have to develop all the components. We have to pay all the people to develop the software, the hardware, the mechanics, everything else. We realize our game is expensive. That's why we're shipping it with two games. Our machines are expensive. That's why we're shipping them with two games. So, like I said before, the cost per game is less expensive than anybody else out there. So thank you for listening to me. I'm going to bring up Dennis Nordman now. We hired him a few months ago to develop our first game theme for us. We're going to talk about that game theme. Dennis will talk about it. And then I'll come back and talk about our second game. And we'll go from there.
So my first question, the first thing I said to Jerry was, I can't design a playfield using only a third of the playfield. But I laid some of my older drawings over his playfield, and it's true what he said. Most of the stuff on your playfield doesn't start till two-thirds of the way up the playfield. Like right about where his wall targets are and the scoops are. So it is possible. I was surprised, but if you look closely at games with inserts and artwork, that's all that's there, really. It looks like there's a lot of stuff there because it's very busy. So Jerry convinced me that it was possible to do it. And I've got my play field essentially all drawn. The layout's all finished. It has two really cool new toys on it, but I'm not going to tell you about that stuff yet because it's not finished. But what I'm going to try to do today is take you through the process I go through of trying to develop a theme for the game, because the stuff doesn't just fall out of your head finished. You got to work on it. You got to think about it. It's not easy, but it's kind of fun. So I have here all my notes that I wrote, and Jerry said, "Well, you're not going to read that, are you?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "Can't you memorize it?" And I said, "Well, no. It's like every gray hair represents a dead memory cell. So I'm going to try to read and talk at the same time." So a lot of this stuff is notes and emails that I sent back and forth to Jerry, back and forth to Rory, our artist. And so I'll just start. So the first thing I have to do after I got hired on with Jerry, he said, and I was really excited because he was going to let me do an original theme. So I wrote, "I've been considering several themes for the P3 game, including a cartoon-style zombie game. I've been wanting to do a zombie game for a couple of years, but now I think it's a little late for that because there's a couple more people that are doing zombie games, so I wanted to do something else. Jerry likes science fiction. I like science fiction. And I was a fan of the Space Quest computer games. Are any of you familiar with the Space Quest games? And that was a theme that I just loved. And it's got humor, and so it's like right up my alley. So so the next thing to do was to come up with a main character for my humorous-style sci-fi game. The Space Quest hero was named Roger Wilco. I thought that was a pretty cool name. So I wrote down a list of all the old famous space heroes that I remember, like Rocky Jones, Flash Gordon, Tom Corbett, Buck Rogers, Captain Video, Buzz Corey, Buzz Lightyear. And I started combining and twisting all this stuff up to come up for a name of who our space hero would be. So I came up with stuff like, I got like a whole list here. I won't read them all because I'll get bored and you'll get bored. But Buck Flash, Flash Corbett, Flash Laser, Rocky Rogers, Flash Rogers, Rocky Gordon, Buck Laser, Buzz Laser, Flash Drive, Flash Rocky, Rocky Flash, Buzz Flash, Flash Buzz, Flash Cosmos, Buck Nebula, Buzz Pulsar, then I've got crazy Buzz Zing, Buzz Ard, Buzz Off, Rocky Terrain, MT Space. But I really liked, I came up with Flash Lightspeed, and I thought, I like that a lot. And then I was watching CNN one night, and I added more names to the list. Wolf Blitzer, Flash Blitzer, Buck Blitzer. So I decided on Flash Lightspeed. I thought that was a pretty cool space hero name. And so then I thought, well, now, so what's Flash going to do? So I came up with this quick little storyline. A little while ago, in a place not far away, Flash Lightspeed and his ship are hurtling out of control towards the Earth. On board are his two crewmen, Ronnie Earl and Little Larry, two rednecks who were abducted from the swamps of Florida while they were hunting a skunk ape. Also aboard is the skunk ape, and he's called a Lookie. He's not a Wookie, he's a Lookie. Because Ronnie Earl and Little Larry would say, "Lookie, there he is!" So that was their name for him, so he's the Lookie. And Ronnie Earl and Little Larry are actually named for my two brothers. I got one brother Ronnie and one brother Larry. And Ronnie's middle name really is Earl, named after my grandfather. So he's the Ronnie Earl. And Little Larry, we call him Little Larry because he's 6'5", 250 pounds. The scene on the LCD is my plan. Will open up with Flash and his ship are crashing somewhere in the American desert. And the ship bounces and skips a few times and starts rolling because it's like a disc-shaped UFO. And it rolls past a sign that reads Area 51, Top Secret. So now what the player will have to do is use the ball to hit various rock piles and caves and eventually find your way by hitting different things on the LCD screen, find your way into this huge underground bunker where there's all kinds of UFO parts and UFOs stored that the government has secreted away. So now the player has to accumulate various bits and pieces of UFOs to rebuild Flash's ship. So that's one of the main things I like about the LCD on the playfield. Is now we can take a player on a visual journey through many different scenes and adventures, something pinball's never done before. Pinball's essentially been abstract when it comes to storyline. The only thing that has changed is a light that turns on and off. The dot matrix changed that a little, but it's located in an area where it's hard to see while you're playing the game. So that's why I really like the concept that Jerry's come up with. We can give you a visual sense of progress through the game by changing scenes. And so I think it's a great reason to keep you playing, the anticipation of seeing what kind of scene might come next. And then another advantage, I think, of this space adventure storyline is that the main characters can have many different adventures. We could create new adventures for these characters that I've created. And so perhaps some of the games is that you just buy a new software package for the same play field, because we can change the description of the target values and stuff by doing that on the LCD screen. So an even cheaper option is just buy new software and plunk it in, and you've got a whole new storyline using the same features. So then I did more thinking, and I was thinking about the Elvira games and the Wonelli game, and I'm thinking, what am I doing a male character for? So I came up with the name Lola Lightspeed. Lola's a sexy, intelligent, witty brunette. She's dressed in black leather, motorcycle boots. She shows a little cleavage and carries a ray gun. And then I wrote, I'm not sold on the name Lola. It doesn't sound intelligent or spacey. And my wife said, Lola sounds like a stripper. So I came up with the name Lexi. So now our space heroine, her name is Lexi Lightspeed. And I'm going on to the art. I thought the art should be kind of a comic book style art, because if we're going to animate this stuff, that's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time. So rather than realistic representation of people, maybe a comic book style. I thought maybe, and this shows you how we think of all different kinds of things and we have to filter it down into something that will work. I thought in the beginning maybe she has wings. Like if you've ever seen anime art and anime angels, I thought they look pretty cool. And if you've ever seen the show Ancient Astronauts, they contend that angels were aliens, so it might be fun to incorporate that anyway. But our artist Roy put the kibosh on that real quick because he thought, that's just going to be too hard to draw when she's sitting down. What are you going to do with the wings? And so I said, okay, we won't do that. Then I went on to the ship. What does the ship look like? I didn't want to do the standard old Star Wars style spaceship with gray or silver and a lot of detail on it. Being a child of the 50s, I like those old 50s tin toy spaceships with the colorful artwork and stuff. So that was one of the ideas. If you ever saw sci-fi magazine covers from the 30s and 40s, almost everything on the cover had a red and yellow saucer or spaceship on it. Everything was red and yellow. That's another style. Another style is 50s retro future, shiny with chrome accents. Roy came up with the idea of a chrome dome on the UFO, and I like that because the crew could see out, but maybe people can't see in it. I told Roy we need to discuss that. So later I'm going to show you pictures of how the Lexi character evolved and how the UFO evolved. Then I started thinking of what kind of features could we have. I thought of a light speed bonus. It would be something like a play field value multiplier, 2 times light speed, 3 times light speed. It could be a junkyard bonus where you increase the value of the items before you collect them. On the LCD, we can cut to new scenes like you do in a movie. One crazy thought, Ronnie Earle, as he's rooting around in all the junk, finds just a household light switch. So he thinks that'll be great to incorporate that into the control panel for the light speed switch for the game. So then your job is to make various shots to add the parts to fix up the ship. Maybe there'll be a display that like a percentage of how much of the ship you have fixed up before you can take off again. So your goal of this game is to fix the UFO and then take off again for another space adventure. Now back to the swamp. Maybe these redneck guys leave bait for the lookie. Maybe Twinkies or Spam or Brownies. I don't know. So then Lexi Lightspeed, I'm thinking it needs a tagline because Lexi Lightspeed really doesn't say what she is or what she does. So my first thought was Lexi Lightspeed Space Babe, but Jerry wasn't crazy about that idea. So I came up with a bunch of other names, Space Ranger, Space Cadet, Space Commando, Galaxy Guardian, Galaxy Trooper, but we eventually settled on Galaxy Girl. Using Jerry's Vux. At first, I hated them because I thought they took up too much space on the playfield. But then, the more I thought about it, I thought of interesting ways that we could use these. Maybe there's a wormhole shot, a shot somewhere on the playfield where the ball goes in and it instantly pops out someplace else through one of his Vux, so it's like magically transported. And Jerry touched on this briefly, but we can enhance the flippers and the slingshots with graphics. The flippers could look like, the slingshots could look like they're on fire. The flippers could look like they're on fire. If you accomplish enough goals, then everything's worth more points when it's on fire. if you see the asteroid game, he's got now, what will really happen is you'll hit the asteroid, it'll blow up, and there'll be a score value there, or a feature value, or something like that. Whatever is floating around on the screen, say it's asteroids, and you hit an asteroid, then there could be something in it or under it that you have to hit again to get an extra ball or start a new mode or something like that. So I'm really excited about all the different things that you can do with this game. So now my theme is more developed, and here's, I'm going to read you of the whole storyline now, as it stands now. But so there's characters, Lexi Lightspeed, Ronnie Earl, Little Larry, and the Swamp Ape. So Lexi's a sexy space fighter who travels the galaxy fighting for truth, justice, and the American way. Oh, that's Superman, never mind. So Lexi, she's hot, she's sexy, and her name is Lexi. So she travels the galaxy searching for space monsters, hunting down the evil ones who fight for the dim side of the Force, not the dark side. She's not fully qualified to go dark yet. So now she has to battle the dim side, but for her, she's aspiring to fight the dark side, and that's more exciting than always looking on the bright side. Ronnie Earl and Little Larry, two rednecks that were abducted by Lexi as her UFO flew over the swamps of Florida. Ronnie Earl is a retired rocket scientist. Do you ever see that show, Rocket City Rednecks? So Ronnie Earl's a retired rocket scientist, used to work at Cape Canaveral. He was on the verge of developing a light-speed engine when he was forced into retirement by budget cuts. He likes to hop up anything and make it faster. In fact, he toyed with the idea of making time faster until he realized that would just shorten his life. Little Larry is Ronnie Earl's younger brother, never quite made the leap from redneck to rocket scientist. So the two brothers like to hunt for the swamp ape in Florida. The swamp ape is a Bigfoot-like creature, and that's what they call him in Florida, is the swamp ape. Ronnie Earl and Little Larry spend their weekend searching for him. Unknown to the two boys, swamp apes, and maybe to a lot of you, swamp apes, Bigfoot, Yetis, etc., are actually sent down from UFOs to gather biological samples. That's why they're rarely seen and only in sparsely populated areas. And they're very intelligent and they can speak, but their voice, however, sounds like a series of burps and it's pretty disgusting. For that reason, not many people talk to them. The swamp ape is known to the boys as a lookie because they say things, looky, there he is, looky, Ronnie Earl, I seen him. One day they get too close, and they are abducted by Lexi's UFO. Lexi needs a couple of crew members, and Ronnie Earl is fascinated by all the technology. He decides to stay. Little Larry follows Ronnie Earl everywhere, so he stays too. Besides, they got nothing going on at the trailer park back home. And they think Lexi is hot. So now the game is a little different. It doesn't start with the UFO crashing. It starts with the boys slogging through the swamp, and as they slog through the swamp, they're raising bubbles of swamp gas, and the bubbles float up and float over their heads. So now you can hit the bubbles with the ball, and every time you hit a bubble, it'll make a fart sound. It's kind of like the scene in Blazing Saddles. And then inside the bubbles will be special stuff, extra balls and things like that. So when the two boys get closer to the lookie, Little Larry shouts, I seen him, I seen him. Ronnie Earl says, shut up, damn it, be quiet. This will be the adult setting. Little Larry says, well, sorry, I'll be as quiet as a mouse pissing on cotton. Ronnie Earl says, there he is, take the shot. And Little Larry has a tranquilizer gun, and he shoots him, but nothing happens. And Ronnie Earl says, damn it, Larry, you couldn't hit water if you fell out of the boat. So Lexi sees what's going on. She sees the shooting. She abducts the two hunters. She beams the lookie back on board, who's now unconscious because Larry did hit him, but it took a while for it to take effect. And when he wakes up, he sees the two hunters. He belches, you two boys are assholes. Ronnie Earl looks at Lexi and says, she's so pretty she could make a hound dog smile. And Little Larry says, whoo, that outfit is so skimpy I can almost see the promised land. This is the adult setting. So the ship takes off. Little Larry sees a lever, pushes it. What's this do? And Lexi says, damn it, Larry, you just shut down the gyro stabilizers. Ship crashes somewhere in the American desert. The ship bounces and skips a few times, starts rolling because it's disc-shaped. Rolls past the sign that says Area 51, top secret. Then on past another sign that says Area 52, super top secret. Past Area 53, double super top secret. and it rolls to a stop at Area 53.1 over the top secret. It's so secret nobody knows about it, it's been forgotten. So they climb out of their ship and look around, and they find out it's a storage area for all the crashed UFOs the government's been keeping secret. The warehouse is full of parts, so the player has to collect the parts. And Ron Errol says, look at all these parts. I believe I can fix this, probably make it go faster too. Little Larry says, what you need is a big hammer. Anyway, so now the player has to help Ron Errol find all the parts to fix the ship. Little Larry has to, one of the features, one of the toys in the game is Little Larry has to protect the four crewmen from aliens that are coming to attack them, because the aliens are kind of like the junkyard dogs of the area, protecting the whole area. When the ship's fixed, then they can be on their way to their new adventure. She's searching for the planet Viagra, where the citizens are beginning to rise up against the evil dictator, Higgs boson, who's never been seen, but they know he exists. So that's our theme. And now I've got pictures on my computer, if we can get it hooked up here. And then I guess after this, there'll be a question and answer session, and if you want anything autographed or defaced with my signature, I'll do it. So just give me a moment here for this to get fired up. What I'm going to show you now is that was the process I used to develop the theme. Now I'm going to show you the process we went through to develop the character, because we didn't know what she looks like, and we have to figure that out. So Jerry found this great artist just recently out of school, but he's a 3D artist. So this game is going to have actual 3D art, kind of like Toy Story. And we'll be able to pose the character. He just has to draw her once, and we can put her in any kind of pose that we want. All right. So we don't know what Lexi looks like. So somebody had to volunteer to look up hot, sexy space women on the internet. So I'll do it. So I wish I could do the slideshow. I'll try to go through this quick. Oh, cool. I love working with all these smart guys. Okay, so I'm just going to go through a bunch of these pictures real quick of fantasy-type space women while we try to figure out. I like Kat Von D because I think she's hot. Jerry didn't like her at all. But Jerry's opinions are often wrong. This was a pretty cool one. Because it's animated kind of style, it's not like photorealistic or anything. This was the outfit. I wanted a top like that instead of a halter top. I don't like those because I don't think they accentuate the form properly. I don't like that horizontal line going across there. These things are important when you're designing a pinball game. And there's a space girl with a ray gun. Another hot one I found. This one I really liked, this image. I thought it was pretty cool. I liked her face. I liked the brunette hair, and I liked the style that it was drawn in. I like these gauntlets on her arms, if that's what you call those things. Another cool space babe. A little sculpture I found. Another one with a ray gun. Nancy Goodaim. That was a pretty good pose. And this was a kind of a steampunk-like version. And then another cool space chick. And these are the ones with the anime angels that I thought, well, maybe, you know. So then Rory took all this information. And, oh, first I went to hairstyles, too. I like the anime hairstyles because I think they're kind of futuristic and look pretty cool. So I gave him a lot of reference of cool hairstyles. But I don't want the big eyes. So this was his first attempt, and I have blocked out her private parts for this presentation, but Jerry and I have seen her naked. So this was the face I thought was awesome. I love the eyes were a little dark. I don't know how it looks up there if you can see the detail very much, but the outfit needed work, so I sent him some her eyes were dark, too dark, so I sent him reference of Siberian Huskies, that their eyes are beautiful. So a couple of those. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if she had one brown one and one blue one? And cat's eyes, of course, are beautiful. I thought, well, what would it look like if we had cat's pupils in our eyes? I don't know. We haven't done that yet, but that's a possibility. So this is his second generation. And I didn't like the shoulder pads. I didn't like the lineman's orthopedic boots that he put on her. But the hairstyle was getting close. So then I sent him pictures of motocross boots, just for reference to jog his imagination and get him going, and motocross shoulder pads and things, because I want her to look tough and strong. So then his next generation was getting a lot closer. The boots look better, shoulder pads look better, but the boots were way too high. They went up above her knees, and I didn't like, I can be so detail-oriented with this stuff. I drove poor Roy crazy. And I didn't want to have gloves on her hands. I thought that would just be too cumbersome. So this is the kind of crazy detail I think about when we're even just trying to do a character for a game. It just doesn't happen. I thought there needed to be some red trim, because I'll show you the UFO in a minute, but her UFO was kind of red and yellow, so I wanted some red and yellow trim. Well, he went overboard with the red and yellow and made everything red and yellow. And I didn't like the back of the hairstyle. I wanted it to be longer, so I scribbled some stuff in there in Photoshop, and that's more like what I wanted, and more black trim on the boots. And I actually thought her bikini line should go up higher, because I'm a man. So, and then so Roy sent back, he tried this hairstyle, and Jerry and I both hated that. So then he went back to this, and now this hairstyle is getting pretty cool, I think. I like it a lot. So then, what's next here? Oh. Wrong. We're back. See how porn can sneak in? Now look at this picture closely. There's no cleavage. I thought, Rory, what are you doing? We got to have cleavage. So I had to show Rory what cleavage looked like. And again, I had to search for this stuff on the internet. So now he's getting there. Now she's getting somewhere. She's looking pretty hot now, I think. The shoulder pads are better. The boots are better. She's got some cleavage. But the holster is way in the wrong place. I mean, she'd have to lift her hand way up here to get her gun out. The stupid details I notice. So I said, Roy, the holster's got to be a lot lower. So I sent him holster reference. See how it's way lower than the belt. Here's a good reference picture to show how it really should be. So the next thing he sent, he puts two ray guns. He gets the holsters in the right place, but he puts two ray guns on her. And that's an interesting idea to try, but both Jerry and I thought it was just a little too bulky looking. And then my wife said about that skimpy red outfit, she said, she looks like she ought to have a pole next to her. So we put some pants on her. I gotta tell her you said that. So what's the vote? Wait, we gotta have a vote here, Jerry.
You can fix it in adult mode.
Okay, there you go. So now we're pretty close on Lexi. I think she's pretty hot. Only on this one he put dark lipstick on her. And I hated that. She looks so much cooler with the light lipstick, I think. So this is pretty much the finished Lexi. And then, so I thought, wow, wouldn't it be cool if we had time to do a poster for the show? And I just comped up a bunch of pictures I found in Photoshop and Photoshopped it all together. This is our spaceship, but these other images I found on the internet. And I thought, well, that'd be like a cool pose. So Roy wanted to do it all in 3D, but some of the things he came up with just weren't looking good. The lighting's way wrong here. The spaceship blends into the background. He just wasn't going to have time to model the mountains and everything. But this is our first 3D view of Lexi. Without color and stuff, of course. So I didn't like this. I didn't like the lighting. I didn't like the color. So I said, you know, if the background was blue, it would really make that red and yellow ship pop really nice. So he does the blue background, but now the lighting is coming from behind and everything looks really dark. So that didn't work either. So then we decided we're just going to go with the spaceship and Lexi for our poster. And I came up with the tagline because I was thinking about curved space and I was thinking about Lexi, and there's got to be some kind of connection there. So I thought, ah, perfect. She's a perfect example of curved space. So then we decided, Jerry and I and Roy decided, we'll just show the ship and Lexi. This background's kind of dark. So we got one with a lighter background, and then we changed the tagline to "She's a perfect example of curved space." Unfortunately, the poster we had printed came out a little dark. But and then, so that's not me. So I wanted to use my brothers as characters in the game, so I asked them to send me. Roy needed pictures of their faces. And this is little Larry. And little Larry can sometimes be a little crazy. And so this is what he sent us. And this is bike week in Daytona. I'm usually down there for bike week with my brothers and my old racing buddies. And I said, Larry, you ought to go walking over on Main Street wearing that outfit. You make a lot of new friends. And then this is our poster that we have. This is the first 3D version of her. It still needs a little bit of work, but Roy's really getting there. And he didn't have a lot of time to do this. What did he have, like about a month or something, I think? So then I sent Roy inspiration for her spaceship, too. I wanted something that looked kind of 50s with two engines on it and a dome. So I sent him a few toys that I found. Here's the red and yellow ships that are always on these old magazines. And this is like a 50s retro modern kind of spaceship. And another one like that. So it's kind of a combination of all of this stuff, what he came up with. And this is Lexi's spaceship. And that little character's in there for scale. So that's our side view. And there's the top view. So we can have this thing flying all around the LCD. That's it. So I guess now we're going to take a little break, and then I'm going to...
Let me just announce the second thing.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. So, and then I'll come back for a question and answer session and autographs or defacing.
So I know we're just about out of time. We spent all of our art development cycles on the Lexi Lightspeed character, so... That's what we're here showing today. We're talking about Dennis's theme, Lexi Lightspeed Galaxy Girl. That's what we have artwork for. It's preliminary artwork, of course, those couple of pictures. The other theme is going to be a cosmic kart racing game. This kart-style racing games that are really popular in the video game world that are really well-suited for different types of interactions. I mentioned before, network multiplayer games, kart racing, any kind of racing game. If you're controlling a character in a vehicle on your machine, and someone else is controlling a character on their machine, and someone else across the world is controlling a character on their machine, it's very well suited for networked multiplayer games. So the second theme, unfortunately, I don't have any artwork to show you. We're going to start developing that soon. But so game one, Lexi Lightspeed Galaxy Girl. Game two, Cosmic Kart Racing. Both we hope to have developed by early 2014. So Ed, when he arranged the seminars, asked me to separate all the multimorphic discussion from a separate Q&A discussion with Dennis about his career, about things he's done, about whatever you guys want to talk about. So before we do that, let me just ask another time if anyone has any questions about multimorphic related things or about the themes Dennis talked about. Maybe just a couple questions before we jump into the Q&A. Yes, please.
Is Rory using Blender?
I actually don't know what tools Rory's using.
And that's magic to us.
Yes.
So like any video game, what happens when you get to the end?
What happens when you get to the end? You don't want me to ruin it for you now.
Well, I mean, you just play it again. I mean,
maybe it doesn't end.
I mean, the problem is like you play a shooter game, like an alien shooter game, get to the end of it, you're like, I'm done.
So games like Attack from Mars or, you know, you get to the end, you rule the universe, what do? It starts over again, you get to rule the universe again. I don't know, we need to figure out the plot details, but some games are fun to keep playing again, some games aren't. So it's a challenge to solve that problem. Lloyd?
Dennis, when you hard up his computer at the Jetsons Bay down there, are you giving Lexi a maid to clean up after the redneck on his spaceship?
Lloyd is asking questions that don't deserve responses. So
we have posters of Lexi, the image that Dennis showed with the you've probably seen it in our booth, the three view in the saucer. We have those posters here. We have them for sale. They're $25 each. We have multimorphic, the game is changing t-shirts in our booth for $20 each. If you're interested in any of those things, come by and get them. Dennis is going to now do his Q&A session, and if you want him to sign these posters, if you have other things you want him to sign, by all means, ask him whatever you want and get his autograph while you can. Thanks.
Okay, I'm back. If you have any questions you want to ask, I don't want to give a presentation because I don't like just standing here talking about myself. So this will be a question and answer session. I'll ask you questions. You give me the answers. If I can remember, I'll even try to answer some of the questions. Yes? About which? Oh, I haven't done much with that game at all. I did some speech for Ben. Yeah. Ben's supposed to have that at the Milwaukee show. Good, there's no more questions. Spooky Pinball, I'm just doing a little consulting work with Chuck on his another new pinball company. So I don't know if he'll have anything to show at Milwaukee or not, but I'm doing a little help, helping him a little with that. And I'm also, after we finished the Wonelli project, Greg and I, then Greg got the job at Stern, so that kind of slowed Whizbang down a lot, but it's 99.9% certain that Stern is going to make a run of the Wonelli Big Juicy Melons game. And So one of the customers that bought Wonelli wants his own custom game, so I'm also building a custom game for him, which is another science fiction, spacey-related theme. But I'm just building one, but I hope to have it done by Expo, and if people want more, maybe it could be manufactured too. I don't know. So if you have stuff for me to autograph, I'm going to go... I'll sit at this table right here, and you just bring your stuff up, and I'll autograph it for you. Thank you.